and Mr. de Tamble turns to me and says, I have a bit of a cold. I've taken some of that cold medicine, but I'm afraid it just makes me drowsy. Henry is sitting on the couch, watching us. All the furniture is white and looks as though it was bought at a J.C. Penney around 1945. The upholstery is protected with clear plastic, and there are vinyl runners over the white carpet. There's a fireplace that looks as though it's never used. Above it is a beautiful ink painting of bamboo and wind. That's a wonderful painting, I say, because no one is saying anything. Mr. de Tamble seems pleased. Do you like it? Annette and I brought it back from Japan in 1962. We bought it in Kyoto, but the original is from China. We thought Kimmy and Dong would like it. It is a 17th century copy of a much older painting. Tell Claire about the poem, Henry says. Yes, the poem goes something like this. Bamboo without mind, yet sends thoughts soaring among clouds. Standing on the lone mountain, quiet, dignified, it typifies the will of a gentleman. Painted and written with a light heart, Wu Chen. That's lovely, I say. Kimmy comes in with drinks on a tray, and Henry and I each take a glass of sangria while Mr. de Tamble carefully grasps his tea with both hands. The cup rattles against the saucer as he sets it on the table beside him. Kimmy sits in a small armchair by the fireplace and sips her sangria. I taste mine and realize that it's really strong. Henry glances at me and raises his eyebrows. Kimmy says, Do you like gardens, Claire? Yes, I say. My mother is a gardener. You got to come out before dinner and see the backyard. All my peonies are blooming, and we got to show you the river. That sounds nice. We all troop out to the yard. I admire the Chicago River, placidly flowing at the foot of a precarious stairway. I admire the peonies. Kimmy asks, What kind of garden does your mom have? Does she grow roses? Kimmy has a tiny but well-ordered rose garden, all hybrid teas, as far as I can tell. She does have a rose garden. Actually, Mama's real passion is irises. Oh, I got irises. They're over there. Kimmy points to a clump of iris. I need to divide them. You think your mom would like some? I don't know. I could ask. Mama has more than 200 varieties of iris. I catch Henry smiling behind Kimmy's back, and I frown at him. I could ask her if she wants to trade you some of hers. She has some that she bred herself, and she likes to give them to friends. Your mother breeds iris? Mr. de Tamble asks. Uh-huh. She also breeds tulips, but the irises are her favorites. She is a professional gardener? No, I say. Just an amateur. She has a gardener who does most of the work, and there's a bunch of people who come in and mow and weed and all that. Must be a big yard, Kimmy says. She leads the way back into the apartment. In the kitchen, a timer goes off. Okay, says Kimmy. It's time to eat. I ask if I can help, but Kimmy waves me into a chair. I sit across from Henry. His dad is on my right, and Kimmy's empty chair is on my left. I notice that Mr. de Tamble is wearing a sweater, even though it's pretty warm in here. Kimmy has very pretty china. There are hummingbirds painted on it. Each of us has a sweating, cold glass of water. Kimmy pours us white wine. She hesitates at Henry's dad's glass, but passes him over when he shakes his head. She brings out salads and sits down. Mr. de Tamble raises his water glass. To the happy couple, he says. Happy couple, says Kimmy, and we all touch glasses and drink. Kimmy says, So, Claire, Henry say you are an artist. What kind of artist? I make paper sculptures. Oh, you have to show me sometime, 'cause I don't know about that. Like origami? No, Henry intercedes. They're like that German artist we saw down at the Art Institute, you know, Anselm Kiefer. Big, dark, scary paper sculptures. Kimmy looks puzzled. Why would a pretty girl like you make ugly things like that? Henry laughs. It's art, Kimmy. Besides, they're beautiful. I use a lot of flowers, I tell Kimmy. If you give me your dead roses, I'll put them in the piece I'm working on now. Okay, she says. What is it? A giant crow, made out of roses, hair, and daylily fiber. Huh. How come a crow? Crows are bad luck. They are? I think they're gorgeous. Mr. DeTamble raises an eyebrow, and for just a second, he does look like Henry. He says, You have peculiar ideas about beauty. Kimmy gets up and clears our salad plates and brings in a bowl of green beans and a steaming plate of roast duck with raspberry pink peppercorn sauce. It's heavenly. I realize where Henry learned to cook. What do you think? Kimmy demands. It's delicious, Kimmy, says Mr. DeTamble, and I echo his praise. Maybe cut down on the sugar? Henry asks. Yeah, I think so too, says Kimmy. It's really tender though, Henry says, and Kimmy grins. I stretch out my hand to pick up my wine glass. Mr. DeTamble nods at me and says, Annette's ring looks well on you. It's very beautiful. Thank you for letting me have it. There's a lot of history in that ring and the wedding band that goes with it. It was made in Paris in 1823 for my great-great-great-grandmother, whose name was Jeanne. It came to America in 1920 with my grandmother, Yvette, and it's been sitting in a drawer since 1969 when Annette died. It's good to see it back out in the light of day. I look at the ring and think, Henry's mom was wearing this when she died. I glance at Henry, who seems to be thinking the same thing, and at Mr. DeTamble, who is eating his duck. Tell me about Annette, I ask Mr. DeTamble. He puts down his fork and leans his elbows on the table, puts his hands against his forehead. He peers at me from behind his hands. Well, I'm sure Henry must have told you something. Yes, a little. I grew up listening to her records. My parents are fans of hers. Mr. DeTamble smiles. Ah. Well then, you know that Annette had the most marvelous voice. Rich and pure. Such a voice. And such range. She could express her soul with that voice. Whenever I listened to her, I felt my life meant more than mere biology. She could really hear. She understood structure, and she could analyze exactly what it was about a piece of music that had to be rendered just so. She was a very emotional person, Annette. She brought that out in other people. After she died, I don't think I ever really felt anything again. He pauses. I can't look at Mr. DeTamble, so I look at Henry. He's staring at his father with an expression of such sadness that I look at my plate. Mr. DeTamble says, But you asked about Annette, not about me. She was kind, and she was a great artist. You don't often find that those go together. Annette made people happy. She was happy herself. She enjoyed life. I only saw her cry twice. Once when I gave her that ring, and the other time when she had Henry. Another pause. Finally, I say, You were very lucky. He smiles, still shielding his face in his hands. Well, we were and we weren't. One minute we had everything we could dream of, and the next minute she was in pieces on the expressway. Henry winces. But don't you think, I persist, that it's better to be extremely happy for a short while, even if you lose it, than to be just okay for your whole life? Mr. DeTamble regards me. He takes his hands away from his face and stares. Then he says, I've often wondered about that. Do you believe it? I think about my childhood, all the waiting and wondering, and the joy of seeing Henry walking through the meadow after not seeing him for weeks, months, And I think about what it was like not to see him for 2 years, and then to find him standing in the reading room at the Newberry Library. The joy of being able to touch him. The luxury of knowing where he is. Of knowing he loves me. Yes, I say. I do. I meet Henry's eyes and smile. Mr. Jetamble nods.
Henry has chosen well.
Kimmy gets up to bring coffee, and while she's in the kitchen, Mr. Jetamble continues.
He isn't calibrated to bring peace to anyone's life. In fact, he is in many ways the opposite of his mother.
Unreliable, volatile, and not even especially concerned with anyone but himself. Tell me, Claire, why on earth would a lovely girl like you want to marry Henry?
Everything in the room seems to hold its breath. Henry stiffens, but doesn't say anything.
I lean forward and smile at Mr. Jetamble and say, with enthusiasm, as though he has asked me what flavor of ice cream I like best, because he's really, really good in bed. In the kitchen, there's a howl of laughter. Mr. Jetamble glances at Henry, who raises his eyebrows and grins. And finally, even Mr. Jetamble smiles and says,
"Touché, my dear."
Later, after we have drunk our coffee and eaten Kimmy's perfect almond tort, after Kimmy has shown me photographs of Henry as a baby, a toddler, a high school senior, to his extreme embarrassment, after Kimmy has extracted more information about my family,
"How many rooms? That many? Hey, buddy, how come you don't tell me she's beautiful and rich?"
We all stand at the front door, and I thank Kimmy for dinner and say goodnight to Mr. Jetamble.
"It was a pleasure, Claire," he says. "But you must call me Richard."
"Thank you, Richard." He takes my hand for a moment, and for just that moment, I see him as Annette must have seen him, years ago. And then it's gone, and he nods awkwardly at Henry, who kisses Kimmy, and we walk downstairs and into the summer evening. It seems like years have passed since we went inside.
"Whoosh," says Henry. "I died 1,000 deaths just watching that."
"Was I okay?"
"Okay? You were brilliant. He loved you."
We are walking down the street, holding hands. There's a playground at the end of the block, and I run to the swings and climb on. And Henry takes the one next to me, facing the opposite direction. And we swing higher and higher, passing each other, sometimes in sync and sometimes streaming past each other so fast it seems like we're going to collide. And we laugh and laugh. And nothing can ever be sad. No one can be lost or dead or far away. Right now we are here. And nothing can mar our perfection or steal the joy of this perfect moment. Wednesday, June 10th, 1992. Claire is 21. I'm sitting by myself at a tiny table in the front window of Café Paragalisi, a venerable little rat hole with excellent coffee. I'm supposed to be working on a paper on Alice in Wonderland for the history of the grotesque class I'm taking this summer. Instead, I'm daydreaming, staring idly at the natives, who are bustling and hustling in the early evening of Halsted Street. I don't often come to Boys Town. I figure I will get more work done if I'm somewhere that no one I know will think to look for me. Henry has disappeared. He's not home, and he wasn't at work today. I am trying not to worry about it. I am trying to cultivate a nonchalant and carefree attitude. Henry can take care of himself. Just because I have no idea where he might be doesn't mean anything is wrong. Who knows? Maybe he's with me. Someone is standing on the other side of the street waving. I squint, focus, and realize that it's the short black woman who was with Ingrid that night at the Aragon. Celia. I wave back, and she crosses the street. Suddenly, she's standing in front of me. She is so small that her face is level with mine, although I am sitting and she is standing.
Hi, Claire,
Celia says. Her voice is like butter. I want to wrap myself in her voice and go to sleep.
Hello, Celia. Have a seat.
She sits opposite me, and I realize that all of her shortness is in her legs. Sitting down, she is much more normal looking.
I hear tell you got engaged, she says.
I hold up my left hand, show her the ring. The waiter slouches over to us, and Celia orders Turkish coffee. She looks at me and gives me a sly smile. Her teeth are white and long and crooked. Her eyes are large, and her eyelids hover halfway closed as though she's falling asleep. Her dreadlocks are piled high and decorated with pink chopsticks that match her shiny pink dress.
You're either brave or crazy, she says.
So people tell me.
Well, by now you ought to know.
I smile, shrug, sip my coffee, which is room temperature and too sweet. Celia says,
Do you know where Henry is right now?
No. Do you know where Ingrid is right now?
Uh-huh, Celia says. She's sitting on a bar stool in Berlin, waiting on me.
She checks her watch.
I'm late.
The light from the street turns her burnt umber skin blue and then purple. She looks like a glamorous Martian. She smiles at me.
Henry is running down Broadway in his birthday suit with a pack of skinheads on his tail.
Oh, no. The waiter brings Celia's coffee, and I point at my cup. He refills it, and I carefully measure a teaspoon of sugar in and stir. Celia stands a demitasse spoon straight up in the tiny cup of Turkish coffee. It is black and dense as molasses. Once upon a time, there were three little sisters, and they lived at the bottom of a well. Why did they live at the bottom of a well? It was a treacle well. Celia is waiting for me to say something. Curtsy while you're thinking what to say, it saves time.
Really? I say. Oh, brilliant, Claire. You don't seem too worried. My man were running around in his all together like that, I would wonder a little bit myself.
Yeah, well, Henry's not exactly the most average person. Celia laughs.
You can say that again, sister.
How much does she know? Does Ingrid know? Celia leans toward me, sips her coffee, opens her eyes wide, raises her eyebrows, and purses her lips.
You really gonna marry him?
A mad impulse makes me say, If you don't believe me, you can watch me do it. Come to the wedding. Celia shakes her head.
Me? You know, Henry don't like me at all. Not one bit.
Well, you don't seem to be a big fan of his, either. Celia grins.
I am now. He dumped Miss Ingrid Carmichael hard, and I'm picking up the pieces.
She glances at her watch again.
Speaking of whom, I am late for my date.
Celia stands up and says, Why don't you come along?
Oh, no thanks.
Come on, girl. You and Ingrid ought to get to know each other. You have so much in common. We'll have a little bachelorette party.
In Berlin?
Celia laughs.
Not the city, the bar.
Her laugh is caramel. It seems to emanate from the body of someone much larger. I don't want her to go, but...
No, I don't think that would be such a good idea.
I look Celia in the eye. It seems mean. Her gaze holds me, and I think of snakes, of cats. Do cats eat bats? Do bats eat cats? Besides, I have to finish this. Celia flashes a look at my notebook.
What, is that homework? Oh, it's a school night. Now, just listen to your big sister Celia, who knows what's best for little schoolgirls. Hey, you old enough to drink?
Yes, I tell her proudly. As of 3 weeks ago. Celia leans close to me. She smells like cinnamon.
Come on, come on, come on.
You gotta live it up a little before you settle down with Mr. Librarian Man. Come on, Claire. Before you know it, you'll be up to your ears in librarian babies shitting their pampers full of that Dewey Decimal System.
I really don't think...
Then don't say nothing, just come on.
Celia is packing up my books and manages to knock over the little pitcher of milk. I start to mop it up, but Celia just marches out of the cafe holding my books. I rush after her.
Celia, don't! I need those!
For someone with short legs and 5-inch heels, she's moving fast.
Uh-uh, I'm not giving them back till you promise you're coming with me.
Ingrid won't like it. We are walking in step, heading south on Halsted toward Belmont. I don't want to see Ingrid. The first and last time I saw her was the Violent Femmes concert, and that's fine with me.
Course she will. Ingrid's been very curious about you.
We turn onto Belmont, walk past tattoo parlors, Indian restaurants, leather shops, and storefront churches. We walk under the L, and there's Berlin. It doesn't look too enticing on the outside. The windows are painted black, and I can hear disco pulsating from the darkness behind the skinny, freckled guy who cards me, but not Celia, stamps our hands, and suffers us to enter the abyss. As my eyes adjust, I realize that the entire place is full of women. Women are crowded around the tiny stage, watching a female stripper strutting in a red sequin G-string and pasties. Women are laughing and flirting at the bar. It's ladies' night. Celia is pulling me toward a table. Ingrid is sitting there by herself, with a tall glass of sky blue liquid in front of her. She looks up, and I can tell that she's not too pleased to see me. Celia kisses Ingrid and waves me to a chair. I remain standing.
Hey, baby,
Celia says to Ingrid.
You've got to be kidding, says Ingrid. What did you bring her for?
They both ignore me. Celia still has her arms wrapped around my books.
It's cool, Ingrid. She's all right. I thought y'all might want to become better acquainted, that's all.
Celia seems almost apologetic, but even I can see that she's enjoying Ingrid's discomfort. Ingrid glares at me.
Why did you come? To gloat?
She leans back in her chair and tilts her chin up. Ingrid looks like a blonde vampire, black velvet jacket and blood-red lips. She is ravishing. I feel like a small-town schoolgirl. I hold out my hands to Celia, and she gives me my books.
I was coerced. I'm leaving now.
I begin to turn away, but Ingrid shoots out a hand and grabs my arm.
Wait a minute!
She wrenches my left hand toward her, and I stumble, and my books go flying. I pull my hand back, and Ingrid says,
You're engaged?
And I realize that she's looking at Henry's ring. I say nothing. Ingrid turns to Celia.
You knew, didn't you?
Celia looks down at the table, says nothing.
You brought her here to rub it in, you bitch.
Her voice is quiet. I can hardly hear her over the pulsing music.
No, Ing, I just...
Fuck you, Celia. Ingrid stands up. For a moment, her face is close to mine, and I imagine Henry kissing those red lips. Ingrid stares at me. She says, You tell Henry he can go to hell, and tell him I'll see him there. She stalks out. Celia is sitting with her face in her hands. I begin to gather up my books. As I turn to go, Celia says, Wait! I wait. Celia says,
I'm sorry, Claire.
I shrug. I walk to the door, and when I turn back, I see that Celia is sitting alone at the table, sipping Ingrid's blue drink and leaning her face against her hand. She is not looking at me. Out on the street, I walk faster and faster until I am at my car, and then I drive home, and I go to my room, and I lie on my bed, and I dial Henry's number. But he's not home, and I turn out the light, but I don't sleep.
Better Living Through Chemistry. Sunday, September 5th, 1993. Claire is 22, Henry is 30. Henry is perusing his dog-eared copy of the physician's desk reference. Not a good sign.
I never realized you were such a drug fiend.
I'm not a drug fiend. I'm an alcoholic.
You're not an alcoholic.
Sure I am.
I lie down on his couch and put my legs across his lap. Henry puts the book on top of my shins and continues to page through it.
You don't drink all that much.
I used to. I slowed down somewhat after I almost killed myself. Also, my dad is a sad cautionary tale.
What are you looking for?
Something I can take for the wedding. I don't want to leave you standing at the altar in front of 400 people.
Yeah, good idea.
I ponder this scenario and shudder.
Let's elope.
He meets my eyes.
Let's, I'm all for it.
My parents would disown me.
Surely not.
You haven't been paying attention. This is a major Broadway production. We are just an excuse for my dad to entertain lavishly and impress all his lawyer buddies. If we bowed out, my parents would have to hire actors to impersonate us.
Let's go down to City Hall and get married beforehand. Then if anything happens, at least we'll be married.
Oh, but I wouldn't like that. It would be lying. I would feel weird. How about we do that after, if the real wedding gets messed up?
Okay, plan B.
He holds out his hand, and I shake it.
So, are you finding anything?
Well, ideally, I would like a neuroleptic called Risperdal, but it won't be marketed until 1994. The next best thing would be Clozaril, and a possible third choice would be Haldol.
They all sound like high-tech cough medicine.
They're antipsychotics.
Seriously?
Yes.
You're not psychotic.
Henry looks at me and makes a horrible face and claws at the air like a silent movie werewolf. Then he says, quite seriously,
"On an EEG, I have the brain of a schizophrenic. More than one doctor has insisted that this little time travel delusion of mine is due to schizophrenia. These drugs block dopamine receptors."
Side effects?
Well, dystonia, akathisia, pseudo-Parkinsonism. That is, involuntary muscle contractions, restlessness, rocking, pacing, insomnia, immobility, lack of facial expression. And then there's tardive dyskinesia, chronic uncontrollable facial muscles, and granulocytosis, the destruction of the body's ability to make white blood cells. And then there's the loss of sexual function, and the fact that all the drugs that are currently available are somewhat sedative.
You're not seriously thinking of taking any of these, are you?
Well, I've taken Haldol in the past, and Thorazine.
And?
Really horrible. I was totally zombified. It felt like my brain was full of Elmer's glue.
And isn't there anything else?
Valium, Librium, Xanax.
Mama takes those, Xanax and Valium.
Yeah, that would make sense.
He makes a face and sets the physician's desk reference aside and says, "Move over." We adjust our positions on the couch until we are lying side by side. It's very cozy.
Don't take anything.
Why not?
You're not sick.
Henry laughs.
That's what I love you for. Your inability to perceive all my hideous flaws.
He's unbuttoning my shirt, and I wrap my hand around his. He looks at me, waiting.
I am a little angry. I don't understand why you talk like that. You're always saying horrible things about yourself. You aren't like that. You're good.
Henry looks at my hand and disengages his, and draws me closer.
I'm not good, he says softly in my ear. But maybe I will be,
You better be.
I'm good to you.
Too true.
Claire?
Do you ever lie awake wondering if I'm some kind of joke God is playing on you?
No. I lie awake worrying that you might disappear and never come back. I lie awake brooding about some of the stuff I sort of half know about in the future. But I have total faith in the idea that we are supposed to be together.
Total faith.
Don't you? Henry kisses me.
Nor time, nor place, nor chance, nor death can bow my least desires unto the least remove.
Come again?
I don't mind if I do.
Braggart.
Now who's saying horrible things about me?
Monday, September 6th, 1993. Henry is 30. I'm sitting on the stoop of a dingy white aluminum-sided house in Humboldt Park. It's Monday morning around 10. I'm waiting for Ben to get back from wherever he is. I don't like this neighborhood very much. I feel kind of exposed sitting here at Ben's door, but he's an extremely punctual guy, so I continue to wait with confidence. I watch two young Hispanic women push baby strollers along the pitched and broken sidewalk. As I meditate on the inequity of city services, I hear someone yell, "Library boy!" in the distance. I look in the direction of the voice, and sure enough, it's Gomez. I groan inwardly. Gomez has an amazing talent for running into me when I'm up to something particularly nefarious. I'll have to get rid of him before Ben shows up. Gomez comes sailing toward me happily. He's wearing his lawyer outfit and carrying his briefcase. I sigh. "Ça va, comrade?"
"Ça va. What are you doing here?"
"Good question." "Waiting on a friend. What time is it?"
"Quarter after 10, September 6th, 1993.
He adds helpfully. "I know, Gomez, but thanks anyway. "You visiting a client?"
"Yeah,
10-year-old girl. Mom's boyfriend made her drink Drano. I do get tired of humans."
"Yeah.
Too many maniacs, not enough Michelangelos."
"You had lunch? Or breakfast, I guess it would be?"
"Yeah, I kind of need to stay here. Wait for my friend."
"I didn't know any of your friends lived out this way.
All the people I know over here are sadly in need of legal counsel." "Friend from library school." And here he is. Ben drives up in a 62 silver Mercedes. The inside is a wreck, but from the outside it's a sweet-looking car. Gomez whistles softly.
"Sorry I'm late," Ben says, hurrying up the walk. "House call."
Gomez looks at me inquisitively. I ignore him. Ben looks at Gomez and at me. "Gomez, Ben, Ben, Gomez. So sorry you have to leave, comrade."
"Actually, I've got a couple hours free."
Ben takes the situation in hand. "Gomez, great meeting you. Some other time, yes?" Ben is quite nearsighted, and he peers kindly at Gomez through his thick glasses that magnify his eyes to twice their normal size. Ben's jingling his keys in his hand. It's making me nervous. We both stand quietly waiting for Gomez to leave.
"Okay. Yeah, well, bye,"
says Gomez. "I'll call you this afternoon," I tell him. He turns without looking at me and walks away. I feel bad, but there are things I don't want Gomez to know, and this is one of them. Ben and I turn to each other, share a look that acknowledges the fact that we know things about each other that are problematic. He opens his front door. I've always itched to try my hand at breaking into Ben's place, because he has a large number and variety of locks and security devices. We enter the dark, narrow hall. It always smells like cabbage in here, even though I know for a fact that Ben never cooks much in the way of food, let alone cabbage. We walk to the back stairway, up into another hallway, through one bedroom and into another, which Ben has set up as a lab. He sets down his bag and hangs up his jacket. I half expect him to put on some tennis shoes, a la Mr. Rogers, but instead he putters around with his coffee maker. I sit down on a folding chair and wait for Ben to finish. More than anyone else I know, Ben looks like a librarian. And I did, in fact, meet him at Rosary, but he quit before finishing his MLS. He's gotten thinner since I saw him last, and lost a little more hair. Ben has AIDS, and every time I see him I pay attention, because I never know how it will go with him. "You're looking good," I tell him. "Massive doses of AZT, and vitamins and yoga and visual imaging. Speaking of which, what can I do for you?" "I'm getting married." Ben is surprised and then delighted.
"Congratulations. To whom?"
"Claire. You met her. The girl with very long red hair."
"Oh. Yes."
Ben looks grave. "She knows?"
Yes. Well, great. He gives me a look that says that this is all very nice, but what of it? So her parents have planned this huge wedding up in Michigan. Church, bridesmaids, rice, the whole nine yards. And a lavish reception at the yacht club afterward. White tie, no less. Ben pours out coffee and hands me a mug with Winnie the Pooh on it. I stir powdered creamer into it. It's cold up here, and the coffee smells bitter, but kind of good. I need to be there. I need to get through about 8 hours of huge, mind-boggling stress without disappearing. Ah! Ben has a way of taking in a problem, just accepting it, which I find very soothing. I need something that's going to KO every dopamine receptor I've got. Navane, Haldol, Thorazine, Serentil, Melaril, Stelazine. Ben polishes his glasses on his sweater. He looks like a large hairless mouse without them. I was hoping you could make this for me. I fish around in my jeans for the paper, find it, and hand it over. Ben squints at it, reads. 3,2-496-fluoro-1,2-benzazoxazole-3-YL, colloidal silicon dioxide, hydroxypropyl, methylcellulose, propylene glycol. He looks up at me, bewildered. What is this? It's a new antipsychotic called risperidone, marketed as Risperdal. It'll be commercially available in 1998, but I would like to try it now. It belongs to a new class of drugs called benzazoxazole derivatives. Where did you get this? PDR, the 2000 edition. Who makes it? Janssen. Henry, you know you don't tolerate antipsychotics very well. Unless this works in some radically different way. They don't know how it works. Selective monoaminergic antagonist with high affinity for serotonin type 2, dopamine type 2, blah blah blah. Well, same old, same old. What makes you think this is going to be any better than Haldol? I smile patiently. It's an educated guess. I don't know for sure. Can you make that? Ben hesitates. I can, yes. How soon? Takes a while to build up in the system. I'll let you know. When's the wedding? October 23rd. What's the dosage? Start with 1 milligram and build from there. Ben stands up, stretches. In the dim light of this cold room, he seems old, jaundiced, paper-skinned. Part of Ben likes the challenge. Hey, let's replicate this avant-garde drug that nobody's even invented yet. And part of him doesn't like the risk. Henry, you don't even know for sure that dopamine's your problem. You've seen the scans. Yeah, why not just live with it? The cure might be worse than the problem. Ben, what if I snap my fingers right now? I stand up, lean close to him, snap my fingers. And right now, you suddenly found yourself standing in Alan's bedroom in 1986. I'd kill the fucker. But you can't because you didn't. Ben closes his eyes, shakes his head. And you can't change anything. He will still get sick. You will still get sick. Und so weiter. What if you had to watch him die over and over? Ben sits in the folding chair. He's not looking at me. That's what it's like, Ben. I mean, yeah, sometimes it's fun. But mostly it's getting lost and stealing and trying to just cope. Ben sighs. God, I don't know why I put up with you. Novelty? My boyish good looks? Dream on. Hey, am I invited to this wedding? I'm startled. It never occurred to me that Ben would want to come. Yeah. Really? You would come? Beats funerals. Great. My side of the church is filling up rapidly. You'll be my 8th guest. Ben laughs. Invite all your ex-girlfriends. That'll swell the ranks. I'd never survive it. Most of them want my head on a stick. Ben gets up and rummages in one of his desk drawers. He pulls out an empty pill bottle and opens another drawer, takes out a huge bottle of capsules, opens it, and places 3 pills in the small bottle. He tosses it to me. What is it? I ask, opening the bottle and shaking a pill onto my palm. It's an endorphin stabilizer combined with an antidepressant. It's... Hey, don't! I popped the pill into my mouth and swallowed. It's morphine-based. Ben sighs. You have the most casually arrogant attitude toward drugs. I like opiates. I bet. Don't think I'm going to let you have a ton of those either. Let me know if you think that would do the job for the wedding, in case this other thing doesn't pan out. They last about 4 hours, so you would need two. Ben nods at the two remaining pills. Don't gobble those up just for fun, okay? Scout's honor. Ben snorts. I pay him for the pills and leave. As I walk downstairs, I feel the rush grab me, and I stop at the bottom of the stairs to luxuriate in it. It's been a while. Whatever Ben has mixed in here, it's fantastic. It's like an orgasm times 10 plus cocaine. And it seems to be getting stronger. As I walk out the front door, I practically trip over Gomez. He's been waiting for me. Care for a ride? Sure. I'm deeply moved by his concern. Or his curiosity. Or whatever. We walk to his car, a Chevy Nova with two bashed headlights. I climb into the passenger seat. Gomez gets in and slams his door. He coaxes the little car into starting, and we set off. The city is gray and dingy, and it's starting to rain. Fat drops smack the windshield as crack houses and empty lots flow by us. Gomez turns on NPR, and they're playing Charles Mingus, who sounds a little slow to me, but then again, why not? It's a free country. Ashland Avenue is full of brain-jarring potholes, but otherwise things are fine. Quite fine, actually. My head is fluid and mobile, like liquid mercury escaped from a broken thermometer, and it's all I can do to keep myself from moaning with pleasure as the drug laps all my nerve endings with its tiny chemical tongues. We pass ESP Psychic Card Reader, Pedro's Tire Outlet, Burger King, Pizza Hut, and I Am the Passenger runs through my head, weaving its way into the Mingus. Gomez says something which I don't catch, and then again. Henry! Yes? What are you on? I'm not quite sure. A science experiment of sorts. Why? Stellar question. I'll get back to you on that. We don't say anything else until the car stops in front of Claire and Charisse's apartment. I look at Gomez in confusion. You need company, he tells me gently. I don't disagree. Gomez lets us in the front door and we walk upstairs. Claire opens the door and when she sees me, she looks upset, relieved, and amused all at once.
I have talked Henry into getting into my bed, and Gomez and I are sitting in the living room drinking tea and eating peanut butter and kiwi jelly sandwiches. Learn to cook, woman, intones Gomez. He sounds like Charlton Heston handing down the Ten Commandments. One of these days, I stir sugar into my tea. Thank you for going and getting him. Anything for you, kitten. He starts to roll a cigarette. Gomez is the only person I know who smokes during a meal. I refrain from commenting. He lights up. He looks at me, and I brace myself. So, what was that little episode all about, hmm? Most of the people who go to compassionate pharmacopoeia are AIDS victims or cancer patients. You know Ben? I don't know why I'm surprised. Gomez knows everybody. I know of Ben. My mom used to go to Ben when she was having chemo. Oh. I review the situation, searching for things I can safely mention. Whatever Ben gave him really put him in the slow zone. We are trying to find something that will help Henry stay in the present. He seems a little too inanimate for daily use. Yeah. Maybe a lower dosage? Why are you doing this? Doing what? Aiding and abetting Mr. Mayhem. Marrying him, no less. Henry calls my name. I get up. Gomez reaches out and grabs my hand. Claire, please. Gomez, Let go. I stare him down. After a long, awful moment, he drops his eyes and lets me go. I hurry down the hall into my room and shut the door. Henry is stretched out like a cat, diagonally across the bed, face down. I take off my shoes and stretch out beside him. How's it going? I ask him. Henry rolls over and smiles.
Heaven.
He strokes my face. Care to join me?
No.
Henry sighs. You are so good. I shouldn't be trying to corrupt you.
I'm not good, I'm afraid.
We lie together in silence for a long time. The sun is shining now, and it shows me my bedroom in early afternoon. The curve of the walnut bed frame, the gold and violet oriental rug, the hairbrush and lipstick and bottle of hand lotion on the bureau. A copy of Art in America with Leon Golub on the cover lies on the seat of my old garage sale armchair, partially obscured by A Rebour. Henry is wearing black socks. His long, bony feet hang off the edge of the bed. He seems thin to me. Henry's eyes are closed. Perhaps he can feel me staring at him because he opens his eyes and smiles at me. His hair is falling into his face, and I brush it back. Henry takes my hand and kisses the palm. I unbutton his jeans and slide my hand over his cock, but Henry shakes his head and takes my hand and holds it.
Sorry, Claire, he says softly. There's something in this stuff that seems to have short-circuited the equipment. Later, maybe. That'll be fun on our wedding night.
Henry shakes his head.
I can't take this for the wedding. It's too much fun. I mean, Ben's a genius, but he's used to working with people who are terminally ill. Whatever he's got in here, it plays like a near-death experience.
He sighs and sets the pill bottle on my nightstand.
I should mail those to Ingrid. This is her perfect drug.
I hear the front door open, and then it slams shut. Gomez leaving. You want something to eat? I ask.
No, thanks.
Is Ben going to make that other drug for you?
He's going to try, Henry says.
What if it's not right?
You mean if Ben fucks up?
Yeah, Henry says.
Whatever happens, we both know I live to be at least 43, so don't worry about it.
43? What happens after 43?
I don't know, Claire. Maybe I figure out how to stay in the present.
He gathers me in and we are quiet. When I wake up later, it is dark, and Henry is sleeping beside me. The little bottle of pills shines red in the light of the LED display of the alarm clock. 43? Monday, September 27th, 1993. Claire is 22. Henry is 30. I let myself into Henry's apartment and turn on the lights. We're going to the opera tonight. It's The Ghosts of Versailles. The Lyric Opera won't seat latecomers, so I'm flustered, and at first I don't realize that no lights means Henry isn't here. Then I do realize it, and I'm annoyed because he's going to make us late. Then I wonder if he's gone. Then I hear someone breathing. I stand still. The breathing is coming from the kitchen. I run into the kitchen and turn on the light, and Henry is lying on the floor, fully clothed, in a strange, rigid pose, staring straight ahead. As I stand there, he makes a low sound, not like a human sound, a groan that clatters in his throat, that tears through his clenched teeth. Oh, God! Oh, God! I call 911. The operator assures me they'll be here in minutes, and as I sit on the kitchen floor staring at Henry, I feel a wave of anger, and I find Henry's Rolodex in his desk, and I dial the number. Hello? The voice is tiny and distant. Is this Ben Madison?
Yes, who is this?
Claire Absher. Listen, Ben, Henry is lying on the floor, totally rigid, and can't talk. What the fuck? What? Shit. Call 911. I did. The drug is mimicking Parkinson's. He needs dopamine. Tell them... Shit, call me from the hospital. They're here. Okay, call me. I hang up and face the paramedics. Later, after the ambulance ride to Mercy Hospital, after Henry has been admitted, injected, and intubated, and is lying in a hospital bed attached to a monitor, relaxed and sleeping, I look up and see a tall, gaunt man in the doorway of Henry's room. And I remember that I have forgotten to call Ben. He walks in and stands across from me on the other side of the bed. The room is dark, and the light from the hallway silhouettes Ben as he bows his head and says, "I'm so sorry. So sorry." I reach across the bed, take his hands. "It's okay. He's going to be fine. Really." Ben shakes his head. "It's completely my fault. I should never have made it for him." "What happened?" Ben sighs and sits down in the chair. I sit on the bed. "It could be several things," he says. "It could be just a side effect, could happen to anybody. But it could be that Henry didn't have the recipe quite right. I mean, it's a lot to memorize, and I couldn't check it." We are both silent. Henry's monitor drips fluid into his arm. An orderly walks by with a cart. Finally, I say, "Ben?" "Yes, Claire." "Do something for me."
"Anything."
"Cut him off. No more drugs. Drugs aren't going to work." Ben grins at me, relieved.
"Just say no."
"Exactly." We laugh. Ben sits with me for a while. When he gets up to leave, he takes my hand and says, "Thank you for being kind about it." He could easily have died. But he didn't.
"No, he didn't."
"See you at the wedding."
"Yes."
We are standing in the hall. In the glaring fluorescent light, Ben looks tired and ill. He ducks his head and turns and walks down the hall. And I turn back to the dim room where Henry lies sleeping.
Turning point. Friday, October 22nd, 1993. Henry is 30. I'm strolling down Linden Street in South Haven, at large for an hour while Claire and her mother do something at the florist's. The wedding is tomorrow, but as the groom, I don't seem to have too many responsibilities. Be there. That's the main item on my to-do list. Claire is constantly being whisked away to fittings, consultations, bridal showers. When I do see her, she always looks rather wistful. It's a clear, cold day and I dawdle. I wish South Haven had a decent bookstore. Even the library consists mainly of Barbara Cartland and John Grisham. I have the Penguin edition of Kleist with me, but I'm not in the mood. I pass an antique shop, a bakery, a bank, another antique shop. As I walk by the barber shop, I peer in. There's an old man being shaved by a dapper little balding barber, and I know at once what I'm going to do. Little bells clang against the door as I walk into the shop. It smells of soap, steam, hair lotion, and elderly flesh. Everything is pale green. The chair is old and ornate with chrome, and there are elaborate bottles lining dark wooden shelves and trays of scissors, combs, and razors. It's almost medical. It's very Norman Rockwell. The barber glances up at me. "Haircut?" I ask. He nods at the row of empty straight-back chairs with magazines neatly stacked on a rack at one end of the row. Sinatra is playing on the radio. I sit down and leaf through a copy of Reader's Digest. The barber wipes traces of lather from the old man's chin and applies aftershave. The old man climbs gingerly from the chair and pays up. The barber helps him into his coat and hands him his cane. "See, George," says the old man as he creeps out. "Bye, Ed," replies the barber. He turns his attention to me. "What'll it be?" I hop into the chair and he steps me up a few inches and swivels me around to face the mirror. I take a long, last look at my hair. I hold my thumb and forefinger about an inch apart. "Cut it all off." He nods his approval and ties a plastic cape around my neck. Soon his scissors are flashing little metal-on-metal noises around my head, and my hair is falling to the floor. When he is done, he brushes me off and removes the cape, and voila! I've become the me
of my future.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Highbridge Audio presents The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenhager.
Get me to the church on time. Saturday, October 23rd, 1993. Henry is 30, Claire is 22. 6 a.m. I wake up at 6 a.m. and it's raining. I'm in a snug little green room under the eaves in a cozy little bed and breakfast called Blake's, which is right on the South Beach in South Haven. Claire's parents have chosen this place. My dad is sleeping in an equally cozy pink room downstairs next to Mrs. Kim in a lovely yellow room. Grandpa and Grams are in the uber-cozy blue master bedroom. I lie in the extra-soft bed under Laura Ashley's sheets, and I can hear the wind flinging itself against the house. The rain is pouring down in sheets. I wonder if I can run in this monsoon. I hear it coursing through the gutters and drumming on the roof, which is about 2 feet above my face. This room is like a garret. It has a delicate little writing desk in case I need to pen any ladylike missives on my wedding day. There's a china ewer and basin on the bureau. If I actually wanted to use them, I'd probably have to break the ice on the water first, because it's quite cold up here. I feel like a pink worm in the core of this green room, as though I've eaten my way in and should be working on becoming a butterfly or something. I'm not real awake here at the moment. I hear somebody coughing. I hear my heart beating and the high-pitched sound, which is my nervous system doing its thing. Oh God, let today be a normal day. Let me be normally befuddled, normally nervous. Get me to the church on time, in time. Let me not startle anyone, especially myself. Let me get through our wedding day as best I can with no special effects. Deliver Claire from unpleasant scenes. Amen.
7 a.m. I wake up in my bed, the bed of my childhood. As I float on the surface of waking, I can't find myself in time. Is it Christmas? Thanksgiving? Is it third grade again? Am I sick? Why is it raining? Outside the yellow curtains, the sky is dead, and the big elm tree is being stripped of its yellow leaves by the wind. I have been dreaming all night. The dreams merge now. In one part of this dream, I was swimming in the ocean. I was a mermaid. I was sort of new at being a mermaid, and one of the other mermaids was trying to teach me. She was giving me mermaid lessons. I was afraid to breathe underwater. The water got into my lungs, and I couldn't figure out how it was supposed to work. It felt terrible, and I kept having to rise up to the surface and breathe, and the other mermaid kept saying, "No, Claire, like this." Until finally I realized that she had gills in her neck, and I did too. And then it was better. Swimming was like flying. All the fish were birds. There was a boat on the surface of the ocean, and we all swam up to see the boat. It was just a little sailboat, and my mother was on it all by herself. I swam up to her, and she was surprised to see me there. She said, "Why, Claire, I thought you were getting married today." And I suddenly realized, the way you do in dreams, that I couldn't get married to Henry if I was a mermaid, and I started to cry. And then I woke up, and it was the middle of the night. So I lay there for a while in the dark, and I made up that I became a regular woman, like the Little Mermaid, except I didn't have any of that nonsense about hideous pain in my feet or getting my tongue cut out. Hans Christian Andersen must have been a very strange and sad person. Then I went back to sleep, and now I am in bed. And Henry and I are getting married today.
7:16 a.m. The ceremony is at 2 p.m., and it'll take me about half an hour to dress and 20 minutes for us to drive over to St. Basil's. It's now 7:16 a.m., which leaves 5 hours and 44 minutes to kill. I throw on jeans and a skanky old flannel shirt and high tops, and creep as quietly as possible downstairs seeking coffee. Dad has beat me to it.
He's sitting in the breakfast room with his hands wrapped around a dainty cup of steaming black Joe. I pour one for myself and sit across from him. Through the lace-curtained windows, the weak light gives Dad a ghostly look.